Hello there, it's Eve. Welcome to the podcast. This is an anonymous story for those we carry, shared with permission. I know that a lot of you listen to the podcast while driving. Please don't do that with this one. This one is longer and something you'll want to be still for. Look, listen to me. You need quiet for this one. You need to be still. Some days, man. Some days. We've all had them. No one told me when I started, look, medicine is a game of ghosts. We're haunted by those we see and those we touch. The ghosts are three-dimensional, fully realized. Brilliant color, surround sound. Your hands still feel their warm blood and cold skin. You can still smell those final minutes. Taste it, blood like a penny under your tongue. Vomit. The plastic of defibrillation pads reminding you of new trainers. Thick barbecue smell of singed fat and muscle. The faces of those you couldn't save. The faces of those with something so catastrophically wrong, there was no way to drag them back out of the hole into which they were sinking. The shocked and suddenly slack faces of the wife, the husband, the sons and daughters, the parents, the ones you've taken into that room. Sat them down and started to say, I'm really sorry, but while you're strung out and dazed yourself from what you've just been through, I'm sorry, I'll stop. We all have those details, I know, and sometimes they come out, and even when you're not really ready to face them. But for me, it's the stories that get me. All of our patients come with their stories, their tales. It's these little details of our lives and what we've been through that binds us together, gives us our humanity. It's the stories we tell that we remember that hit us hardest. And those memories are the ones that are buried deepest, rooted around in the oldest parts of our brain. So entangled with our emotions and our senses that when they surface, it's overwhelming. So this is supposed to be about sharing. I guess it's about catharsis, and it is, but I want to try and give voice to someone whose voice is no longer with us. And I think he would like that. This is a story about a warm summer's night. I work in a rural district general hospital as a consultant in anesthetics and intensive care in the UK. We don't have neuro or cardiac surgery, but because we're remote, we deal with a lot of things ourselves before transfer, and it's often us that have to do the transfer. And for some reason, I have a near 100% record of some kind of intracranial disaster on my ICU weeks. And this is one of those. I was called from home to Rhesus on Saturday for a teenage boy who had been hauled out of the river where they'd been swimming. He had been in cardiac arrest for a long time, but by the time I got to the ED, his heart was beating again. A young, fit heart can withstand a lot. I spent the next few hours with him, water pouring out of his lungs, every few minutes disconnecting the vent and draining the river from his chest. 100% oxygen, sat stuck in the 60s. PEEP doesn't work on river water. We dialyzed, got the inotropes right, got him warm. I spoke to the tertiary center about ECMO, knowing what they would say, but making them say it anyway. No, down too long, too unstable for transfer. I sat down with his parents, his young siblings, again in that room. The one with the sofa, and the water fountain, and the landscape paintings on the wall. Tiny boxes of tissues. Stunned, tearful faces. Thank you, doctor. Thank you to all of you. I was off. Post-call from 8 a.m. on Sunday. And I spent it outdoors in the sunshine. Away from rooms with no windows, with continuous beeps. And then Monday, 8 a.m., back to the basement. Greeted before I even go into our unit by his mom, dad, and siblings. Still there. Look exhausted. Hi, doctor. And even on Monday, on that first day, I knew which way it was going to go. We'd scanned his brain on admission to make sure he hadn't had a hemorrhage or stroke to cause loss of consciousness in the water. And even then, a few hours after, it had looked bad. Swollen, damaged, loss of gray-white matter differentiation. Starved of oxygen for so long, the brain tissue broke down, destroying the normal architecture. But the strength of youthful physiology is incredible. Biology finds a way to survive. Kidney function returned to normal in a couple days. He came off the vasoconstrictors quickly, and even his lungs recovered fast. He was breathing on his own. But then came the twitching. Coarse, erratic jerks of his legs and facial muscles. Not the patterns of muscles that give facial expressions, but isolated little bundles of muscle on his chin, above the eyebrow, and the cheek. And I remember standing at the side of the bed while all this went on, explaining to his parents that this was a bad sign. Despite their elation that the pumps and machines disappeared from his room, I had been clear with them from the start. I was worried about his brain. He had been down for a long, long time. Down. Medical vernacular so often nothing less than the practical truth. As in face down in the water, down. Before his friends realized he was missing and found him down. Before the ambulance crew got there, down the rutted earth track. Before they started CPR. Before they shocked him repeatedly in the ambulance while they drove, quick as they dare, to the hospital. His lungs full of river instead of oxygen. And the second scan confirmed the worst. Severe damage, very tight. And because he was so young, I spoke to the tertiary guys again, to the radiologists, to get a second opinion on the scan. Devastating. Even the initial scan looks bad. I know. I knew what I was going to do. I had known from Monday morning, to be honest. It was just his brain that was broken now. And I remember standing in his room watching. Twitches had become finer. Rapid, shallow breathing. A healthy, well-muscled boy already growing into a man. Just out swimming in the river on a warm summer evening, the kind that go on forever up here this far north. I sat down in that room with his family. All of them on our sofa below the paintings and its boxes of tissues, perched on chairs, crouched down against the wall. I took one of our ICU nurses, as I always do. I needed both a witness for what I was going to say. And because nurses and family grow to support one another quickly, sitting as they do in that room together, hour after hour, and I knew that both parties had to be there. I had a right to be there. I have their absolute, unbroken attention. And they watch me wide-eyed as I sit myself down in the middle of them. I take out my phones and put them face down away from me. You have my unbroken attention too, is the message I'm trying to say. And I tell them, I'm so sorry. His brain is gone. He's breathing on his own. He isn't dead, but his brain has been destroyed too long without oxygen. And in that stoical British way, they take the news quietly. His older sister, only just a woman herself, cries, silent tears, but she doesn't look away. I want to ask you something. His mom, exhausted and drawn, looks back at me. He has the chance to help others, I say. His body has recovered well. His organs have the possibility of saving several lives. And my voice is steady. And inside, I am not. My heart does some origami flip inside my chest and I wait. His sister answers almost immediately. He would want that. We've talked about this. We've all talked about this. And if he could, if he was here, he would want you to do it. His mom and dad nod with certainty. He would. He always wanted to help others. If he can, we would like to do that. Another little origami flip. Thank you, I say. Thank you. I talk quickly and kindly through practical matters. I warn them that there is paperwork, that the process is not quick. It may take another 24 to 36 hours before things happen. And they nod quickly. They have made their decision. They need to grieve. I thank them again and leave them to it. As I walk back into the unit, everyone gives me a bit of space. I hide behind a coffee. I want to cry, but manage to hold it together. He's only just older than my stepson. As predicted, these things take time. The donor coordinators arrive and start the matching process, paperwork, further investigations. Things are signed, samples taken, infusions started and changed. I walk out of the unit that evening knowing that retrieval will likely happen the next day, all being well. It's still hot outside, and the feel of sunshine on my skin makes me glad to be outside of our sterile lights in the basement unit, away from the beeps and the sadness. I'm grateful to turn my back on it for a few hours. I'm grateful that I have the choice. The next day, it's clear it's been a busy night for the donor team. Much has been achieved. As I arrive in the changing room, there are unknown faces asking where the scrubs are, boxes of supplies brought to ensure the team has everything they need close to hand. They're setting up in the theater closest to the ICU, and I know that this morning will be the time. His family, his mom and dad, have made a plan to say their goodbyes and leave. They do not want to watch me extubate him, to be there as his heart stops. I give them space. They do not really need or want to speak to me now. They just want their boy. And I cannot give him back. Oh. It reaches time to go. I extubate him in his room, talking to him as I would any other patient, saying reassuring phrases, saying his name. I do not ask one of the nurses to do it. I do not want to ask them to do this. His oxygen requirements have gone up overnight and he desaturates quickly. And within 20 minutes, his heart has stopped. And he's gone. I take him through to theater, confirm his identity, his number, that he has been confirmed dead. And I do not stay to watch. I have other things to do. I keep coming back to this family days and weeks later. This is nowhere near my first or last organ donation, sadly, but this family stays with me. To this young man who had in one short moment in a conversation with his sister said something so fateful that would impact the lives of others, said an earnest and abstract concept that he couldn't have fully realized or understood, I want to donate my organs. It didn't need to be fully grasped to have seen people dying of liver failure or experienced a close relative suffer living the life of dialysis. That basic humanity to care for others, to voice the wish that if he could, he would want to help. Such a powerful, resonant sentence that it would be remembered and acted upon in the most profound way. He could not have known. He will never know. That little conversation saved lives, alleviated much suffering, and I want so much to be able to thank him. He would have been a great man, I think. No, he was a great man. And in other ways, too, this family comes back and lives with me. I cannot help but think of them holding their breath, gazing at me, knowing what I'm going to say, knowing that I'm going to definitively bring their world shattering down around them to hear me say those words. He's going to die. We cannot save him. To absorb that and then have the strength and the selflessness to think of others at the worst moment of their lives. It's extraordinary and beautiful. I'm so humbled by that. And every time it happens, I'm amazed and humbled anew. I'll end this here. I don't need to tell you about the times I'm out running long, long distances and I'm tired and it hurts. And I think of this family and how they had the depth to be strong when they had no choice. And I cry quiet tears alone in the hills. I can run another couple of miles, can't I? If they can do that, I can do this. I don't need to tell you about how I won't go near that part of the river. I don't need to tell you his name. The name I can never forget. You have your own stories like mine that never seem to leave you. From this medicine, this game of ghosts we play.